GAA on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
All right, I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Neil Cotter. How's it going?
Very well.
Author of this book, Dublin, The Chaos Years, How the Dubs Made a Mess of Things for So Long and How They Turned It Around. A reminder, Neil, I guess, that Dublin weren't always this unstoppable juggernaut.
They weren't. It's a snappy title, isn't it?
Yeah.
We like to keep things concise and brief. No, they weren't. They won in 95, but then I don't think anybody would have seen a 16-year drought, which is effectively what it was.
The glory years, as the rest of the country now call it.
I also notice in this studio you've got a Dublin jersey hidden away.
Oh yeah, we don't. I'm surprised the Mayo jersey isn't hanging right here, is what they tell you on hill16.com in the forums. But anyways, enough about that.
It was, Dublin had been thereabouts for a couple of years before. They won it in 95. Most people remember they got to a couple of finals. They had that four-game sequence with Meath, and they were always one of the top two or three teams in the country. So probably when they won in 95, when they fell over the line, which is probably what they did, nobody would have foreseen a 16-year drought.
Like, in a way, we still don't know maybe enough of this current Dublin side because of the way the culture has changed, because there's a secrecy around an awful lot of what they do, which is understandable because they're so far ahead and they don't want to let everybody else in. And maybe in 15, 20 years, we'll have these brilliant books, and maybe even with the players as they start to retire, we'll get the great stories. Mm. But it's great to remember that actually it wasn't always so easy, that there was this time when it was a right old struggle. And as you say, it was a bit of a mess. For you, looking back, like, I guess this was probably the team you grew up with. You were one of those Dubs fans, were you, on the hill?
I was.
Humiliated, ashamed, and many times.
Yeah, and you kind of just got used to that humiliation after a while. It was a joy to follow Dublin in those days. It still is for different reasons, because I'm just, let people know, I'm a supporter first and foremost. I'm a journalist, but I'm not a sports journalist. I'm not a GAA journalist. I'm a fan who was standing on Hill 16 probably in 2016 at a Leinster turkey shoot, and I was bored, and I was just thinking, you know what, it wasn't always like this. There must be something more. So,
and is that the general feeling of fans on Hill 16 now?
I don't want to speak for anybody else because I got in trouble for doing this before, but amongst my circle it is. With success, with four in a row, comes a little bit of complacency, comes a little bit of, we've lost the sense of joy that we had, say, in 2011 when Cluxton nailed that point. I can't even begin to describe what that feeling was like. You will probably never know.
Well, that was just uncalled for. Bloody hell, now the gloves are off. That's it. We're going all in.
But it hasn't come close to that since.
We're the only thing that give you any joy now. Beating Mayo is the only thing that Dublin supporters have to live for.
We missed you last season, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would imagine
down Newbridge.
So with that in mind, and having journeyed with the team for so long, I'd say it was a brilliant nostalgic trip, and having the opportunity, actually, because you got great buy-in during the book from so many of the key figures, both the county board level, management level, player level, to actually spend some time with them and talk about what their experience was.
Yeah, and in order to write this book, you did need serious buy-in, and I have to thank everybody, because they didn't know me from Adam, and they gave me great access, and they spoke very openly and honestly, and I don't know if sports people do that anymore. I don't know if they can, because sponsorship and all that sort of stuff. So these guys, once you're removed from it a little bit, it's 10, 15, 20 years ago, you can speak openly and honestly, and that's what they did, and it was a real eye-opener, because even though I was a supporter back then as a child or as a teenager, you had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. And that's kind of what I wanted to find out, is why we weren't winning when there were obviously good players there.
Mm. You mentioned Keith Barr as somebody in particular who you found was incredibly insightful and really liked the way that they actually spoke.
Well, Keith, the reason I ran Keith initially was because people were kind of saying bad things about him. So I was like, I better give him a... Better give him a right of reply here. And he turned out to be the star, probably, of the first half of the book. He's incredibly forthright and honest fella, but he's not a guy I would like to play with, I don't think.
Why?
He wasn't a fella who would openly welcome people into the dressing room. You know, he'd been around the block himself by 1996. He'd lost a lot. He'd been hardened by that defeat. And new guys coming in just didn't get the arm around the shoulder from Keith at all. And he's kind of the view that if you want to share this dressing room with me, well, then you've got to earn your place. Now, maybe that still happens in dressing rooms. Mm. None of us really know, because nobody talks as honestly as Keith Barr does.
And when you spoke to him now then, 20 years on, did he still feel the same, that that was the right thing at the time for that Dublin group? Or did he look and think, well, actually, some of these younger players maybe couldn't perform to their best because of the atmosphere that was there?
Well, that's the thing. Like, you look at, say, Ray Cosgrove. He was actually around in 1996, and he was brilliant in training, but he didn't get close to the team when it mattered because, well, player power probably played a part. But Ray eventually made a breakthrough 6 years later in 2002. But he could have done it a lot sooner, maybe, if Keith had been a little bit more welcoming towards him. But he wasn't. And he's kind of unapologetic about that.
I was going to say, like, now when he, and I presume you went to him and when you told him what people had said, like, what was his reaction to the negativity that was out there?
I cannot dispute or deny it, I think were his exact words. He goes, I was the way I was. He says, but you have to understand that that Dublin dressing room was a hard place. It was a hard place to be. And it was very much split by the time 1996 rolled around. There was a new manager under Mickey Whelan. And it was the old guard and there was the new guard trying to find their way, who were actually made change in a separate dressing room out in Santry where they used to train back in those days. It was, you had the...
So what, was your All-Ireland medal your key to one dressing room?
Pretty much, yeah. So you had all the old guys sitting in one dressing room with the other guys. Now, they'll argue that they were small dressing rooms anyway and there might have been a bit of overspill, but yeah, the new guys would have to go and sit change somewhere else.
I know if you spoke to someone like Tony Hannahoe about dark days for Dublin football, he'd go back to playing Division 2 football against Kilkenny in front of a couple of hundred people in the early 1970s. I guess what's so interesting here about Dublin is that they had just won an All-Ireland final in 1995 under Pat O'Neill, and then it unravels so quickly. 7 years without even a Leinster title, 16 years without an All-Ireland. By the end of the book, had you figured out why it unravelled so quickly after 95?
I had, but people are going to have to buy the book to find that out. No, it was just very much a case of that those players, those established players, are adamant they would have won a second or a third All-Ireland had Dr. Pat O'Neill stayed on, had Mickey Whelan not taken over. Would they have done so? We'll never know. They were definitely flagging. They were an ageing team, and it happens in every sport and every team. That, you know, you reach a stage, you peak, and then you start coming down. Just, did they peak too soon, or had they peaked and that was it?
Yeah, it's so bizarre now when you talk about Mickey Whelan in those ways, because he's seen as something of a messiah in Dublin football for his influence on St Vincent's, his influence on Pat Gilroy, and still to this day, his enduring legacy in Dublin football. But chapter one, the opening lines are, Mickey Whelan was ahead of his time, or so goes the accepted wisdom. Mm. 2 decades on, when you're talking to the players about those couple of years under Mickey Whelan, are they still wondering where was this magic that people now talk about?
Yeah, they are. And particularly, you know, Keith Barr and Paul Clark were both kind of critical of Mickey Whelan. He kind of, see, the problem with Mickey was, he's an abrasive character himself, and he came in and it's like in any organisation, if you're doing things a certain way and then you bring in a new guy and the new guy tries to change everything without explaining why he's changing and why it's going to be for your benefit, it's going to cause friction. So Keith says maybe, you know, people didn't buy into the trainer rather than the training. But the training, when it was, this Dublin team were used to doing laps, that's what they did. Kicked a few balls at the end of training or whatever. So Mickey came in with his drills with the ball and all that sort of thing, and the players were kind of going, is this guy for real? Why are we doing this? And I guess the thinking with the players is he never actually explained why they were doing these drills and why it might have worked. Now, Mickey got his redemption in the end. I don't know if he sees it that way, but clearly to coach the team that made the breakthrough in 2011 is a redemption of sorts. But he had a miserable time for 2 years.
Was he then a sort of Clough at Leeds 44 days type figure, that it was just there was clearly a genius there, it was just wrong place, wrong time?
Yeah, he kind of came in and said, some of the players were saying he came in and just said, you know, one of the worst full back lines to win in All-Ireland, for example. And they don't know whether he was being serious or whether he was trying to be funny or whether he was trying to lay down a marker or what he was trying to do. It might work in other dressing rooms. It didn't work in that particular dressing room.
I guess for some reason I'm always tempted to go with Mickey Whelan's side of things, even though results weren't there. So clearly it was.
But the young players really admired what he was doing and they really liked what he was doing, and they didn't like what they saw as bad behaviour from the established players, who they felt were kind of doing their own thing.
And I guess you'd have to assume as well, Mickey Whelan saw that, that these players, they'd won an All-Ireland, but he wanted to win one as well. So there was no living on past glories here, that if they wanted to go to another level again and a Meath team and a Kerry team coming through, if they wanted to challenge them, actually, they couldn't stand still.
Yeah, well, he probably saw them for what they were, was that it was a team probably in decline. But one of the other players from that time, Eamon Heery, who Whelan brought back, Eamon had missed the All-Ireland in 95, and he kind of said that Mickey was, you know, kind of tricking lads by saying their stats were up and all that when they weren't, you know, just to try and get that last couple of ounces out of them that maybe weren't there anymore. Now Keith Barr and all these other lads will deny that until the day
I bet you they will.
They'll say I was fine, I was grand. Like, Keith was only 27 at that time.
Right, so still had a long way to go. So then you go on to the Tommy Carr years, and again there's no Leinster title. And is all that because of what had happened, do you think, under Mickey Whelan, that it had just fallen apart there and that it was going to be almost impossible for Tommy Carr to rebuild it?
I think Tommy Carr's job was to try and break up the cliques and try and get everybody pulling in the same direction. Now, he did it. He got there, but it took him 4 years to do so, and he didn't win anything. It's unthinkable now that any Dublin manager would get 4 years without winning anything. Some people who are being critical of Tommy would say that he should have done it in 2 years or 1 year, but Tommy will say it's much easier said than done to try and get rid of all these veterans who you'd played with, who you mightn't have got on with as players, and then you come in, and he was only 36 when he took over, never coached at any level, still playing club football himself, and he came in then and he was trying to kind of get everybody pulling in the one direction, and he admits himself he found it hard. He tried to work with what he had at the start, but didn't really work out, and got there eventually, but in the sense that he created a lot of harmony in the dressing room. Everybody was sorry to see him go, but he didn't achieve where it mattered most.
Dublin now, they're not just the envy of every county for their players, but also for what goes on at county board level, the way that they are driven, how successful they've become, how professional an outfit it is, and how that's helped the success of the current side. When you look behind the scenes at that stage then, having won the All-Ireland, the pretty rapid decline, struggling for results, struggling to win Leinster titles, behind the scenes, what's going on in Dublin football?
Well, I think that 95 All-Ireland masked a horror show behind the scenes. The schools were in decline, the clubs were dying, nothing was happening, nobody was volunteering anymore. And John Bailey, who is much maligned in Dublin history, in fairness to him, he between himself and Bertie Ahern, stopped a serious rot.
Yeah, I gotta say, I wouldn't have known a huge amount about John Bailey except what you'd sort of hear anecdotally, but reading this, I think he comes across quite well. He was the one person who seemed to have some sort of a vision to try and turn things round. And like, you talk about the lack of volunteerism. There's a line from Bertie Ahern in the book that at the end of school, if you stood there at the bell, you'd be run over by kids running home once upon a time. Now you'd be run over by teachers, just desperate to get out. Yeah. Did you figure out, and it's a long time ago, why that ethic of volunteerism and of bringing kids through at school level had fallen away?
Just from discussing it with the guys, we didn't dig too deeply into it, because I think that's probably a book in itself. For example, there was clubs like Ballymun Kickhams, famous clubs, Nafina, who didn't have teams at underage levels. I mean, I played for Nafina myself at the time, and I remember being under 12 and there wasn't a team above me, there wasn't a team below me. And my brother, who was a few years younger, was playing on the same team as myself.
And was that because there wasn't the numbers available, or just that
there wasn't people weren't playing, and I guess there weren't people to take charge either. But the schools is what they were really concerned about, because Dublin used to have very strong schools. Most of the Christian Brothers schools, like O'Connell's and St Aidan's and Ortscoleriachan's, huge, really famous schools like that, were struggling, and they couldn't get the players, and the teachers weren't coaching them. So Bailey did this survey. He said, where are we weakest? Coaching. What do we have to do? We're going to have to pay to bring in some coaches. And he approached Bertie Ahern, and Bertie Ahern was Minister for Finance, and it's not a bad position to be in when you want to save the team you support. So that's what he did, and they eventually secured about $1 million a year for those clubs. But it wasn't a case of just throwing the money at Dublin either, like people are kind of saying now. The clubs had to come up with half the money for the coaches as well, and think about it, in the 1990s, money was tight. They had to come up with 20 grand a year, it took a long time for the clubs to buy into this because they're thinking, well, hang on, I can't afford 20 grand a year.
Well, it feels now as well that it was quite both ambitious and quite brave, because in such an amateur game, to go out and say, actually, the way for us to get back is we're going to pay people. Mm. We are literally going to go out and we're going to pay people 35, 40 grand a year to coach our players, and we're going to ignore the voluntary side, but that's not stepping up to the mark, so we're going to fill that gap in some way.
It was professionalising what's an amateur sport, and some people were uncomfortable with that, and it took 8 or 9 years, but eventually the clubs all bought into it, and without it, and I know this from speaking to people at various clubs, they would have been dead. And people who are criticised Dublin now for being too strong, would they prefer them to be too strong or dead?
Mm. Yeah, depends who you ask, I guess, at this stage. You mentioned Bertie, and he is a pivotal figure in certain parts of this because of his love for Dublin football and also the position he holds at the time as Minister of Finance. How important was he then in that period of Dublin football and being able to arrange the finances? Is he the main figure involved?
Well, the redevelopment of Parnell Park as well, he secured, I think, $500,000 from the state coffers as well for that. And he even says in the book that he still has the spade from the groundbreaking and keeps it out in his shed. And every time he goes out to do the garden, he has to decide, oh, better not use that spade. But he also got them the money for the floodlights then as well for Parnell Park, which before the redevelopment, it wasn't fit for purpose, basically. So Bertie was heavily involved in redevelopment of Parnell Park, and he was also a central character in this professionalisation of the coaching structures across the city as well. So, again, another fellow who's much maligned, but
from a Dublin football point of view,
as one player said to me, he says Dublin GA would be dead if Bertie hadn't got involved.
And private money then coming into Dublin, was it around that time as well that they sought private investment? I know at one stage that the Dublin players had a name, the Taliban, for certain figures that would arrive into training.
Yeah, Tommy Lyons was another good guy who was good at raising money as well. Now, Pat Gilroy would take that on to new levels, but Lyons started that whole thing. It wasn't really Tommy Carr's thing, but Lyons had a few businessmen who were willing to put their hands in their pockets.
And, so that was just for training camps, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that sort of whatever Dublin needed. Dublin were always well-funded, to be fair. But I think the money, it's two separate things, that, you know, the commercial revenue and the fundraising, and then you've got the coaching for the schools. And people sometimes confuse that as the same thing when it's not.
So they never had a problem raising funds for the senior football team?
Not really.
It was at juvenile level. A lot of counties would similarly echo that to this day, I think.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to see their name on the jersey of the senior football team.
Yeah, and in fairness, Mayo are fantastic at raising funds as well, and Tyrone and Kerry as well, but Dublin have always been quite adept at it.
What was the sense of the Tommy Lyons era from those who were part of it?
I think they all wish he just left after the first year. Now,
was it after the first year that the players voted him out?
It was after the second year. It was in 2003. But the thing with Tommy Lyons is, and I in the book, whenever somebody is critical of an individual, I always try and balance it with something else, because these guys are amateurs and they're doing it for free. They're not paid managers.
Sure.
The players put in a huge amount. You don't want to be critical of a guy who's doing all this out of love for the jersey. So Tommy Lyons, he has shipped a lot of criticism, but he did some good things for Dublin football too. He won that first Leinster in 7 years. Like, that's unthinkable. But that's what he did. And that first year, he brought in the young players and he kind of set them loose. And he said, go off and play. And they were brilliant in 2002.
And brought in good people around him as well.
Yeah, he did. He did. And he had Pillar as well, who people weren't too sure about.
Why?
He was seen as a little bit of a yes man under Tommy Lyons. He wouldn't have spoken out of turn and he wouldn't have disagreed with the manager or anything. So when Pillar then went on to get the job, there's a lot of people going, oh, for God's sake, you know, is this the best we can do? But he quickly changed their minds. And Pillar is another fellow who did some extraordinary things for Dublin as well. He gets criticised too, but he did some great things.
Well, he was there for the 5 in a row Leinster titles, but not able to go and seal the deal in an All-Ireland final. Like, that's probably the most famous recent era of Dublin football in a way, because of the lack of getting the job done and would they ever get it done, and so many horrific defeats in important games. When you spoke to the players from a decade ago, and some of them are still in and around the game at this stage, like, was there a consensus as to why they couldn't deliver on the biggest occasions?
Everybody has a different theory. I guess under Pillar Caffrey, I think the general feeling is that they didn't, he'd never used the squad. He pretty much would pick the same 15 every week or every couple of weeks whenever they were playing a match. The squad members didn't feel included. Like, Pillar's weaknesses were he treated the first 15 as the men and the rest of them were almost like the boys. He would take the first 15 into a pre-match huddle and everybody else could kind of just go and wait somewhere else, which isn't going to foster a great spirit on match day. But the funny thing is, off the field, they're a very close bunch and coaches were very close with the players. And they kind of felt, one of the coaches at that time was Paul Clark, who's back involved now with Jim Gavin. And he's kind of asking in the book, he says, Jesus, were we too nice? Were we too friendly? Did we all get on too well?
Right. So it was actually, it was a very happy camp.
Very happy, happy camp. Yeah. They drank together, trained together, went off on weekends together. They're all best of friends and they're still best of friends. And even the lads who won in All-Ireland eventually in 2011, their first thought would have been for the lads who were with them under Pillar who didn't win in All-Ireland, because that's how close they were.
So there wasn't that gap that's, I assume, is there with Jim Gavin and his players, whereby he keeps a safe distance away.
God, no, they'd be clinking glasses and having a few pints together and all that sort of stuff.
Where does John Costello come into the mix?
John Costello is an extraordinary administrator who's done a fabulous job at Dublin. I don't go into too much detail about John Costello in the book. In fairness to John, I did speak to him about doing an interview and he said he wasn't interested this time and that was grand, but he would have been heavily involved with Pat Gilroy about what he was doing with the commercial side of things. And you know, the two of them worked very closely together in bringing in all these secondary sponsors and, of course, obviously the main sponsor, Vodafone. Again, he's another character that, without him, perhaps the course of history might have been a little bit different too. So I think there's a book in John Costello also.
You're not done just yet, is what you're saying.
He might do it himself.
Yeah, quite possibly. One of the things, I've been living in Dublin for 10 years at this stage, but maybe when you're not from here, you don't realise it as much, is actually the divide between clubs. And understandably, there's rivalry. You just forget how far that can go. And actually, for so much of these chaos years, the actual rivalry between some of the bigger clubs and players been selected, no players been selected from Kilmacook Crokes, or too many players been selected from Kilmacook Crokes, was such a destabilising factor, it seemed, for so many of these managers.
Yeah, and the anti-Kilmacook Crokes bias is quite extraordinary. I had no idea.
Where did it come from?
The people from Kilmacook Crokes who played at that time reckons it came from bad experiences endured by some players who had played previously. Like Mick Pender, for example, was a substitute goalkeeper when John O'Leary was dominating that position. They always felt that he had a fairly unhappy time some of the time in the Dublin setup, but so did other lads, and the stories would come back. You know, for example, there was one story, there was one guy who had just joined the Dublin panel from Kilmacud, and someone picked up his bag and threw it into the showers for a wash. And then there was another guy who was deliberately skipped when they were handing cans of beer out on a team holiday. Little things like that, it would come back to Kilmacud and they'd all be like, can't be having this, you know, because the Kilmacud boys, they were Kilmacud first, Dublin second, and they were kind of seen as softer country lads. And some of the hardened Dublin players that we were talking about didn't like that. Now, it's hard to believe because obviously in 2011, Kilmacud and the Southside teams provided a huge number of players to that team.
But so was it a bit of a Northside-Southside rivalry?
The Northside-Southside thing, they say it was always there in Dublin football because it was always dominated by Northside teams. But Kilmacud had just started doing well in Dublin and in Leinster at that point in the early 90s, early to mid 90s. I think there was a bit of jealousy there, a bit of bitter rivalry, but it was poisonous. And it seeped down, and you know, even lads from Kilmacud would travel together out to training and they'd travel together out to matches and they'd all be bitching about lads from the Fianna who were getting in ahead of them and all that sort of, it always came down to club rivalries.
Right.
So, but again, Tommy Carr would have done a good bit of work to kind of try and break up those little cliques. And by the time he had left, it had pretty much been solved.
Yeah, I can't imagine there's too many players anywhere now that are club first, county second, particularly with the success that Dublin are having.
Yeah.
Neil, thanks a million for coming in. It was all great except for that moment where you harshly insulted all the people of Mayo. I hope I see you in tears on the hill next September. It's all that will make me happy right now. But well done with the bus.
You'll probably be on the hill as well, because Mayo fans always get on the hill for the final.
We're always squeezing in there. There's too many books written at this stage about the glory years of Dublin. It's good to have something very different. Dublin, the chaos years, how the Dubs made a mess of things for so long and how they turned it round. All good bookshops right now. Neil Cotter, best of luck with it.
Thanks very much.
GAA on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.